Welcome to Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle, coming up on the programme this week.
I kind of felt like at school, I then became the kid whose dad died. I was already feeling quite self-conscious at school and trying to shrink.
That's not a healthy relationship that we have with grief. And actually, I thought it was interesting when the Queen did die. I was thinking, well, maybe this is what people need. Like this thing where everyone can talk about it if they want to.
It does stay with you. And I think that's quite typical of all elements of mental health. If you do just try and brush it under the carpet, it can stay with you if you don't deal with it.
And I'll be reminding you how you can make connections with mental health organisations within your community. It's Mental Health Monday.
The home of the UK's conversation about mental health. Great to have you with us. Thank you for downloading the podcast once again. And if you want to like and subscribe to Mental Health Monday, you can find us wherever you get your podcast. It's a pleasure to have you with us. And thanks for checking us out. Thanks for your conversations, comments around Gareth Daunty's episode, our previous episode of the podcast, where we were talking about the Mood app, and also Gareth's journey from a mental health point of view and actually finding ways of visualizing some of the things that he was experiencing. Also an opportunity to talk about gardening and mental health. I am absolutely obsessed with it. And I'll be honest with you, I am past the point of feeling embarrassed about feeling passionate about something. One of the great overused phrases I think that there are in lives are guilty pleasures. What are your guilty pleasures? And people then say, oh, I really like doing this, or I really like this song. And I often think, why do we have to put the word guilty in guilty pleasures? What do we have to feel guilty for? Like, as long as it's not something that's really, really bad. But you know, like someone say, I love this track. Or I like Taylor Swift, right? I'm a 41-year-old bloke. I wouldn't describe that as a guilty pleasure. But if some 21-year-old heard me listening to Taylor Swift, they'd probably think that was pretty embarrassing. But the thing is, you get to the age, right? You don't feel embarrassed anymore. I don't care. I just really like Taylor Swift. In the same way, I really like gardening. Thanks for checking out the podcast this week. We've got Jack Dodd as our guest. Now, Jack's such a great guy. So much in Jack's story about himself. And there's a lot of issues that we're going to touch on as part of Jack's story as well. All born out of his own sort of lived experience. And that can feature bullying. He talks about grief and trauma at a young age. OCD. And then, what about this for a taboo subject? Crying at work. Jack's story covers all of those issues. So it's a really, really good conversation. And it's great to catch up with people like Jack who have had an experience in their life or multiple experiences in their lives. And as we touched on in last week's episode, they now have the self-awareness to then try and think and assess about how that made them feel, maybe why they felt like that, to get an understanding of why that is. And as Jack will hear, that comes through the help of people like therapists and so on and so forth. But actually to find that time and make time for yourself to try and get to grips with things you've experienced in the past and the things that are just ticking away on your mind that have not been dealt with, to actually, at an appropriate point, bring them to the fore, to look at them before you can put them back into the drawer or put them back up onto the shelf or however you want to manage those particular experiences. I think Jack gives a really great picture of how that can happen and how you can use that as something to move forward with from a mental health point of view. He's a really, really great guest. There's so much in this in terms of issues, relatability, things that you might have experienced yourself from a different point of view. So it was a pleasure to catch up with Jack, and I've actually put a link on the podcast notes to his LinkedIn page. Now, I don't normally link in with LinkedIn because sometimes people say it's a bit businessy, but actually, as we'll hear in the conversation, there was a particular post that went viral on LinkedIn, which really almost enhanced his reputation as someone who speaks really positive from a mental health point of view online. That link is in the podcast notes as well. And I started off by talking to Jack about what was the moment for him or the time in his life where he became aware that he was on this mental health journey.
Yeah, I think for me, it was probably becoming an adult and leaving school and sick form behind and kind of being out there, out of that system. Because when I was 13, my dad passed away. And to be honest with you, looking back now, it sounds strange, but I kind of took it in my stride and didn't really, it happened very suddenly. So I didn't really, with hindsight, acknowledge the shock and everything that I was going through. I was very focused on my studies and just, you know, school was the world to me at that age. And then as I came out of education full time, it then kind of hit me a little bit around my mental health. And then, to be honest, it's been a kind of series of different realizations as I've got older. I'm 29 now. So, yeah, several moments really.
Your early 20s in particular are tough years. I think as men in particular, you don't get told that at any point, do you? We're sort of told that your difficult times are sort of like 14, 15, 16, when your hormones are kicking in and you're trying to flirt with somebody you fancy and things like that. And it's awkward and it's weird time and your body grows at different, you know, one leg's longer than the other. All these sort of strange things are going. Nobody ever says, you know what, becoming an adult and then looking at yourself in a mirror and thinking, oh, I'm supposed to have this now. I'm supposed to own this situation now. Nobody ever sits you down and has that conversation. I think it's quite a frightening time. I know I didn't cope with it at all. Mm. And actually, me not coping with it felt to me as if that was an example of me not being able to just handle adult life. Mm. That I wasn't cut out, if you like, for what life was going to throw at me.
Yeah, for sure. I think you're going through so many changes. You know, for me, I went to university and I actually left after about 6 weeks because I was struggling with mental health. I didn't really realize it at the time. I just thought that I didn't want to do that course. So I left. But yeah, you have so many other, your friends are kind of moving in different places. I had a difficult time at school and I think I kind of pushed back against school as this like bad experience for me. And I was just determined to make it through school and to get out of school. But then I didn't realize that actually when I'd left school, all of those issues that I had previously would still be with me when I was sat at home without those like kind of external factors. And yeah, I don't think people do talk about that challenge. And to be honest with you, I think that challenge does continue into your 20s, a lot of your 20s. And I've definitely now in the best place that I've ever been. And I think that is partly due to therapy and various other different things. But I think it is also with age and with experience of life, like things do get better and easier and happier in my experience.
You mentioned losing your dad at such a young age. And of course, that's, you know, a huge moment in anyone and any young person's life. You say you sort of dealt with it at the time. I know as well at the same time, there were sort of external factors were kicking in around bullying for you in school. That's a pretty toxic combination, isn't it, of difficult time at home plus the space where you could relax being actually a place where you were also feeling unsafe. That must have been trying to find a balance there or trying to just find a headspace around that must have been so, so difficult.
Yeah. Again, it's not something that I've really realized how difficult it was or the impact that it's had on me really until recent times. I think, like I said, at the time, I was just trying to get through it and I didn't really acknowledge it. I didn't really have you know, a therapist at the time to kind of help me to realize those feelings and the complexities of what I was going through. I actually remember, and it's something I've been reflecting on just this week, actually. I remember for like an English assignment, we could write about anything. And this was just before my dad died. And I was writing about the impact of being kind of bullied and like how I was feeling. And looking back, it was quite the first time I think I'd really tried to put my emotions into writing and kind of used it for a school assignment. And I really decided to like start describing how I felt. And it was a little bit dark, but it felt quite cathartic. But midway, while I was working on this assignment, my dad did die. My dad died of a heart attack, dropped me off at school one day, didn't pick me up, essentially, is what happened. And I remember just completely scrapping that and that I wanted to write about my dad's death instead. In my head, it was a similar kind of piece around like how I was feeling, but I found it back at my mum's house recently. And it was actually just, it was more me trying to be positive about the fact that my dad had died and that I was going to use this as an opportunity to work harder at school. And that was a good thing because I had someone looking over me, like just completely neglected how I was feeling. So I think looking back and with years of hindsight, you know, I didn't acknowledge really those difficult feelings around being bullied and how I felt and not feeling like I fitted in, But then it kind of just completely swept out of the way. And then I just had this new massive shock to deal with. And, you know, my therapist said to me, ultimately, you were a child at the time. And, you know, it's like a child's decision to just be like, oh, it's fine. You know, I'll just get on with it. I'll use this as a way of like motivating me without actually acknowledging that my dad has just died and the impact that it's had on me. So I find that quite a story that I think is quite representative of how I coped and the impact that it's had on me.
And it's really, it's almost quite a sweet response because you're almost thinking, what would Blue Peter say to me? And this one, like, what would, and they go, you know, it almost that sort of like, oh, keep calm and carry on, you know, let's try and look positive and let's be I think reflects maybe where you're at. And of course, we're not taught at a young age about grief. And grief is one of those things which we deal with so badly. I often say, when the Queen died last year, literally there was like 12 days of mourning. There was minute silences. There was process. There was moments of reflection for like days and days and days. And what happens if your dad dies, your mum dies, your nan or your grand, someone close to you dies? You get the afternoon off and a couple of days maybe to get your head around it. You go back into work, then you get 2 weeks. You go 2 weeks later, you have a funeral, and then you're back into work. And then you're expected to have kind of got over it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's not a healthy relationship that we have with grief. And actually, I thought it was interesting when the Queen did die, I was thinking, well, maybe this is what people need. Like this thing where everyone can talk about it if they want to. Everyone can share their own thoughts. There's a considered period of time that people can get their heads around what's happening and the hope that then we can all move on together. Mm-hmm. And you trying to deal with that as a child is absolutely huge a thing to deal with. Mm-hmm. It's not a surprise, if you like, that the attitude you took was thinking, well, I'll try and be positive, because what else did you have?
Yeah, it's very true. And I went back into school like the next day after it happened, and I wanted to just carry on. And you know, adults are generally quite poor, I think, at talking about grief in our society. So you know, how can we expect children to be able to talk about it? You know, my friends did not know how to talk about it. And I kind of felt like at school, I then became the kid whose dad died because, you know, people in my class were told about it and word spread. So, you know, I was already feeling quite self-conscious at school and trying to shrink. And then more attention is kind of coming your way. So again, it encouraged me more to try and brush it off. And, you know, of course, my mum, you know, encouraged me to talk, and her friends and the people that I had around me kind of did, of course, talk about it. But again, you know, there is that period, like you alluded to, where, you know, for kind of like 2 weeks, kind of in that run up to the funeral, a lot of people are around, a lot of people are very conscious about how you're feeling. But then people do naturally move on with their lives and don't kind of revisit those conversations. And, you know, it's so important to give yourself all the time and the space. You know, here I am 16 years later, and it still doesn't kind of feel real that my dad died. And I was thinking about it yesterday, and I can still kind of bring up those emotions of shock. And, you know, like it's really important, because if you don't deal with it, like it does stay with you. And I think that's quite typical of all elements of mental health. If you do just try and brush it under the carpet, it can stay with you. And if you don't deal with it.
You mentioned your relationship at school and the focus that you were under. Is bullying the right word for this in terms of what you were dealing with at school?
Yeah, I would say so. When I pretty much, as soon as I went to secondary school, my peers kind of thought that I was gay by how I spoke, and I'd never even heard of being gay before. I had no idea what it was. So it was, yeah, a massive shock to me. I went to a state primary school and then a private secondary school. So that was a big change for me as well. I only had one person that I knew from my school that went to this same new school. So it was new people. But yeah, from almost the first minute, kind of having this scrutiny and these comments. And I hadn't really experienced anything before like that. So I didn't know how to stick up for myself. I'd always been brought up to be very kind. And so I didn't really say anything back. And yeah, that kind of continued, really. And that was really my experience of secondary school.
Is part of the issue around bullying, particularly for people in the LGBT community at that age, is that that you're being targeted for something about yourself, and it might be a physical thing or something about you and your personality. But then I guess at the same time, you're also dealing with, you said that you didn't know what being gay was, but then I guess as the years moved on, you then started to think, oh, actually, maybe this is this. So there's two bits of conflict or two bits of awareness. You've got to be aware of what's going on around you, but then you're also learning something new about yourself, and actually you need this. Both of those things take 100% of your time, I imagine.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess, you know, when you're thrown into that environment and you are being picked on, and the spotlight is on you for, you know, not the right reasons, as far as you're aware, the first thing is to deny it, you know, just to continually deny. And then, yeah, probably then as the years go on and the penny starts to drop, that you're kind of like, but I've spent so long denying that I am, that it's kind of, it's really hard to then reconcile actually being comfortable with it, really from a place of safety, ultimately. It's kind of, for me, it kind of got to the point where I could no longer deny it. And I tried for so long, because of course I didn't want to be this thing that kids were saying was such a negative thing. You're right that there is a very little space to really come to your own conclusions and kind of go through your own natural process when you're kind of being forced into it, really.
I think sometimes there's an element of that, and I've certainly found this as I've got older. I'm quite happy to be placed in a box which I associate myself with, like a box of my choosing. If someone says, like, geek, or, you know, if someone says something about my dad jokes, I'll go, no, that's fine, because I've already stood in the dad jokes box and I tell dad jokes, like, or if, like, if it's something about, I was always very sort of tall and skinny, like beanpole. So I had a lot of, like, geek, beanpole. I was lucky that Harry Potter happened a little bit later, because I was that would have been the thing, that I was the sort of the Harry Potter type character. But at the same time, the world is trying to force its boxes on you at any one of those points. And if those things don't happen in the right orders, the world puts you in a box before you've decided that's a box that you're comfortable with being in. It creates this sort of real mismatch, I think, in your mind. And actually makes you feel the negative about the preconceptions that people have, even if ultimately turns out that that was a pretty appropriate box. It's not for anyone else to tell you that that was the box that you were due to go in.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And I think you also don't get to explore all the different aspects of your identity as well. You know, one thing that was difficult for me was things like the changing rooms, where it kind of felt like the comments would increase. And sport's always been a big part of my life. So I didn't really feel like I could be in the sports space, and like that's a part of my identity and something that I really enjoy, so it kind of felt like I couldn't really explore that. And then I'm also a huge football fan, and have been since I was a child. And again, I didn't, like, the people that were picking on me were the people that were also interested in football, so I couldn't really explore those conversations and build that commonality, because ultimately I was afraid of those people. So all these other aspects to yourself, they can be really minimized. And you're right, though, like, you know, now if anybody did kind of call me gay, then it's very easy to be like, well, yes, I am, like, you move on. Like, it's very easy to own that. But, and obviously, if I could go back in time and be the person that I am now back in school, that's how I would have dealt with it, and, you know, had a lot more strength in myself. But it's just so hard as you're a child to be able to handle that situation and to be able to own it and to know, whilst you said, you know, you're working through everything at that age.
Yeah, sure, sure. It's interesting actually talking about, you know, when we talk about football, the football space, and, oh, why are there not more gay football players? Or they must be there. I was like, let's go and find them. Like, let's. And actually, it's interesting here you say that actually, rather than looking in the now, we almost need to look 5-10 years into the past and go, all right, well, what were those corridors that were closed off to individuals, to the LGBT community, which meant they didn't pursue, which means you then do create a space potentially where there's not anywhere near as much representation, because back down the line, you closed a door, or you created enough obstacles for people to think, well, this isn't a space for me anymore.
Yeah, I totally agree. Totally agree.
Can I ask you about a diagnosis? We talked about difficult times in your childhood there, but we started the conversation by talking about those early 20s. Did you find that there was when we talk about labels as well, was there a diagnosis that kicked in at any point? Was there a moment where you thought a conversation at this point with somebody who knows what they're talking about might give me a sense of maybe some of these things that I'm dealing with?
Not really at that age. I remember going to a GP, I think perhaps when I was 18, 19, around that time of trying to embed myself in university, and a GP said to me they thought I had mild OCD, and I remember not really understanding much about it. The fact that they said it was mild, I thought, oh, it was probably kind of nothing. So, and I did have some therapy at that time as well, and you know, generally therapy moves away from kind of labels and won't kind of diagnose in that respect. So no, not until I was, I think, more kind of like in my mid-20s did the words kind of like anxiety and OCD get introduced to me with like a full understanding.
That word mild is so, it's almost offensive, isn't it? Like that someone would go, well, here's a label I might place in, but it's not that bad. Like, so you, I guess you almost feel, oh, well, I'm not worthy of saying that I've got OCD because it's only my, and it's not worth me pursuing this because it's only mild. That the doctor maybe just used that as a you know, well, this might be an issue. But I think language is so important in this space, isn't it? That hearing that word mild made you think, well, it can't be too much then, or this isn't something I should pursue or look into because I've been told it's only mild.
Yeah, and like you mentioned, you know, I can understand where they were coming from, and you know, I think they were, you know, just doing their job, and I have no criticism of that at all. I think then when I fast forward my life with regards to OCD, and ultimately I didn't really take it seriously until it kind of got really bad, and that's unfortunately the downside of not being aware and not taking something serious earlier on. It really took me for things to get quite extreme, where I was really suffering with it, for them to really take it seriously, and that ultimately, that was the launching point really for me to start to speak out about mental health, was just this realization of actually, if you don't tackle these things can actually get really tough, and it doesn't have to be that way. So it's really important to raise awareness and for people to have these conversations.
Were there things happening in your life at that dark, in those darker moments, or was it an escalation of things that had happened before? When you look back now and think about that, what were the triggers to that, or was it just the pathway you'd found yourself on?
I think it was a combination of where I was at in my life at the time. So it was just coming out of the pandemic, and I'd split up from my boyfriend at the time. It was a kind of a long-term relationship. So I was trying to adjust to a life outside of the pandemic, like, you know, all of us were, and it's quite a confusing and strange time. I'd come out of a relationship. I then had to move back in with my mum and my stepdad for the time being while I tried to figure out where I wanted to live. I was going through a process of changing jobs. So there was just so many factors that meant I just felt like things were really uncertain. And I felt, you know, very anxious about kind of not knowing what to do. So, yeah, that really led to my OCD kind of increasing. And that's actually been a pattern for me, actually, the couple of times where I have come out of a relationship and it's been quite stressful trying to find like a new place to live. My OCD then has really shown up at those times.
When you get like a flare up from an OCD point of view, what are the impacts, emotional impacts on you? What are those things that you start to feel about yourself, if you like?
I think, I mean, in terms of the kind of symptoms, for me, it was noticing that I was being extra careful around like the kitchen, and getting very fearful of things like contamination and cleaning more than I would usually. And then also like leaving my flat and then needing to check that I'd locked the door several times, or thinking that had I put the handbrake on my car, and then I would feel really kind of anxious about that. And for me, you know, I'm sure a lot of us can relate to a lot of those situations. And for most of the time, I kind of get those thoughts and they just pass. But in those moments, it's the level of fear that kind of goes kind of 0 to 100 is an exaggeration, but you get the sense of, you know, it just kind of, the feelings just hit me very, very quick. And in those moments, I mean, to be honest with you, I haven't had flare-ups like that for a significant amount of time now, but yeah, it's just incredibly hard to know what to do. Because of course, when you're feeling panic and terror at that level, is how I would describe it, naturally, you don't really think straight. Your instant reaction is to go out and check that the handbrake on your car or check that lock. But the really cruel aspect of OCD is that once you do that, it doesn't reassure you. You need to do it again. And like, it creates this cycle that ultimately just kind of keeps going until you learn how to manage the feelings and break it and that kind of thing. So yeah, that's in my past, that's when I've noticed that things have kind of started to get bad.
That sounds emotionally exhausting to be in that state of fear or terror. Physically exhausting, I imagine, at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I was living by myself at the time, and you know, it's really hard as well for friends and family members to know how to help as well. And it's really tricky because when I'm in those moments, I kind of I remember that being aware that I wasn't being rational, and kind of knowing that this was a real heightened response, but I didn't know how to handle it, and I didn't know what I could do to kind of get a grip on it. And then, you know, when you do speak to someone and say, actually, I'm feeling really scared because I'm feeling this because of that, to somebody else, it can sound really small. And I'm also aware of that too. And I almost feel like a child in those moments, that I'm saying, I'm feeling really anxious because, you know, I've touched a bin when I'm out and X, Y, and Z. And I'm aware that it sounds strange to people. So you kind of have to wrestle with those feelings of feeling embarrassed. You know, so it does feel very cruel, the kind of barriers that you have to overcome just to try and get the level of support that you need. And that's why obviously having kind of professional help and therapy is so vital, because it's really hard to know how else to get the support.
That's always interesting when people talk about the diagnosis, when we sort of the mild OCD becomes a diagnosis of OCD, albeit what's that, 5, 6 years, 7 years down the line. When you describe those behaviors, people might go, oh yeah, that's really irrational. What's that all about? Does it help to then be able to go, it's OCD, or I have OCD? So then you can kind of go, and the symptoms of OCD are this, this, and this. So that thing I'm talking about is this symptom. Does it rationalize in your own mind how you should feel about it? Because you can pinpoint it to a label, a box, if you like.
Mm. Yeah, I think it definitely helped me. It helped me to feel like I wasn't alone, and that just that I wasn't kind of going crazy is ultimately how I felt. And that, you know, that there are other people that experience it, and it is a diagnosable condition. So, yeah, I think it did take the kind of pressure off me, and it kind of gave me something tangible to be able to say to friends, I've been diagnosed with OCD. This is what it is. Here's a link to this website, and that'll give you more information so that you can kind of better understand. And, you know, I remember buying a book about OCD and kind of giving it to my mum, and to be able to say, like, this is what's going on for me. So that's really helpful, because the words to describe your experience are kind of being written by somebody else, so that you don't have to kind of, especially at a difficult time, to be able to pull upon that from yourself. So yeah, I did find it helpful at the time.
You're not 30 yet, but already sort of spreading this message around mental health, obviously the number of hats you could be wearing, you know, you could go and speak to people about your LGBT experience, about your OCD, you could speak to people about grief. When you do talk about your mental health, do you have to talk about it as like the whole? Because I guess if you said, oh, I was dealing with, say, dealing with bullying for being gay when you're young, if you then told that story but then didn't mention that there were other things going, would you feel like you weren't giving the full picture? I'm not saying you need to give everything of yourself all the time, but do you feel like that whole experience actually is your story, as opposed to it being that thing and then that thing and then that thing all happening separately?
Yeah, I mean, everything is kind of linked and they all make up who I am and the experience that I've had, I believe. But it's also very hard to be able to give that level of nuance. It would take a full book, I think, to fully be able to describe everything. And it's a question that I've had, that I've asked myself, actually, because I started posting on LinkedIn about mental health, and things kind of blew up when I first started doing it. And that one thing led to another. And I first started speaking out about taking medication for OCD. And again, that was really fueled by this frustration with myself and the world that I hadn't felt comfortable to open up about it before. And now I was so certain that I want to spread awareness and be open about it that I wanted to post about it publicly. Didn't quite envisage how public it would go. And then I did then post about different experiences that did draw upon different aspects of myself and different kind of challenges. And I did ask myself, should I be purely posting about OCD or about, like you said, about being LGBT, and almost as if I need to give the people that started following me like the same kind of theme? But actually the reason why I did it was to speak my truth and to open up. And I don't really want to limit myself, I guess.
There's a danger, you get a t-shirt that says OCD guy.
Yeah.
And then you then go, oh, by the way, this other stuff's going on. And they're like, that's not what we're here for, Jack. We only want to hear the OCD stories. It's a false narrative, isn't it? To do it that way. I think it's huge as well. The response as well. And LinkedIn's a strange old place, isn't it? Sometimes in terms of like who you make a connection with, because sometimes people are there purely for promotions and showing off they've got a BMW. Fine. Loads of people have got BMWs. But at the other time, people use it as their sort of personal space as well. And I think sometimes it undercuts what they expect to see, because those personal experiences within that sort of business environment, I think, almost shocks people into reading that, makes them think, oh, this is going on. There are other stories in place here, not just me trying to tell everybody that I went to Cancun again.
Yeah, LinkedIn, like you said, it is a unique space. And all of those kind of ingredients that you've mentioned like really motivated me to start to talk, because I remember looking up my LinkedIn feed and seeing at one point just purely about people's achievements and often just the rosy side of work. And, you know, I think there's definitely a place for that. But I know that in my own career, I'd struggled so much with mental health and I'd hidden it, that I knew that it wasn't real of me to only post about the achievements. And, you know, I'd started to see some other people post about their mental health. And I thought, hang on a minute, you know, like, this is a real opportunity for me to be myself, to be real on a platform and in a forum that typically has shied away from that. And the one post that I wrote, which was about ultimately just feeling sad at times in the workplace and crying and kind of raising a message around kind of like men's mental health, I mean, that went viral and just completely took me by surprise with something that was, to be honest, quite straightforward and just an open admission, that it really kind of captivated people's attention and so many people commented. And you know, I had people like around the world contact me in this kind of really intense few days of just, you know, and it really kind of caught me by surprise, but I guess really highlights that, like how unique at the time it was to be talking about that stuff on a platform that generally hasn't spoken about that, maybe.
I think as well, it highlights as well how people, although they might not even know they're there for that content, if we can call it that, when they see it and they relate to it, they want that connection. They want to hear those types of stories. That actually, this idea that people don't want to talk about their mental health or don't want to hear about their mental health is actually quite a false narrative that we've taught ourselves as a society. And actually, that when we share our stories, we actually give people the language to also then share theirs and then go, that's me, that is. Or read this thing this guy's written. That's how I feel. Someone may never have been able to express that before, but then suddenly see somebody else write. It gives them that the authenticity of experience, and it validates their own experience as well. So I think that's why people like yourself, I think, play such a vital role in this, that you're just being you, but just being you is enough. Like, that is enough, because that's the thing which people want. They want the validation. They want the authentic stories. And with that comes those feelings of compassion and empathy and everything in between.
Yeah, you're so right. Especially when you, I've tried to, when I've written about it and tried to post it, like tried to keep it as simple as possible, in the sense that I say simple, but as in like literally just labeling the emotions, because again, I think that's something that as a society we've kind of shied away from. And when you do just mention those emotions, and you know, you do talk about like the post that I mentioned, kind of, I mentioned that there was a time when I'd cried at my desk, or I'd cried in a meeting room, I'd cried in the toilets at work. You know, these things that to me were just very factual, like they happened. They weren't happening every week. They just happened throughout the span of my career. Very like natural things. And, you know, just I write in a way that's, I'd say, quite kind of direct. And, you know, by just making that point, I think that is what people kind of related to, because it was so simple and it was so honest and matter of fact that, like you said, you know, people do just want to connect with other people on an authentic level. And I think in so many aspects of our society, we do so many things to move away from that. And that actually, when you do break that down, ultimately, that is what people want, is just reality, human connection, truth, honesty. And that can also be hard as well. I've learned that can be also hard for people as well, if they're not used to that. And because it can, I think some people find that hard if they're not comfortable themselves with being that honest and that vulnerable, that someone else's vulnerability can also be tricky for them to manage. So, but on the whole, I think it is what people want, and people do relate to it.
Jack, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate you speaking to us. We will put a link to your LinkedIn on the podcast notes as well, so people can follow you there, and the work that you're up to as well. And people can find out more information about the stories that you tell. But I really think that many different aspects of your stories will relate to people and people listening to the podcast today. And thank you for joining us on Mental Health Monday.
Thank you very much for having me.
I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Thanks for checking out Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle. You can find me on Twitter at Mr. Mick Coyle. You can also find me, Mick Coyle, on Facebook as well. Don't forget, if you want to speak to somebody about your mental health, you can do so. The Samaritans, free to call on 116 123. You can find mental health services where you are. Just look for the Hub of Hope. Type in your postcode. It'll find those mental health services close to you. And for support in a crisis, you can text SHOUT to 85258. That's if you're experiencing a personal crisis, you're unable to cope and need support. Shout to 85258. That's a text line. Do get involved in those services. In an absolute emergency, always remember the number to call is 999. Thanks for downloading the podcast this week. We'll be back next week with more Mental Health Monday.